News.
Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on the website 989fm.com.au or on our podcast a little bit later, welcome to you as well. It's really good to have your company. And I trust you all have had a really great, long weekend. Yesterday we heard from Paul Daly, who's a writer from The Guardian, who helped us give some context to Anzac Day and the sort of nationalism that's sort of been going on over the past, building over the past few years around Gallipoli, and helping us remember also the first wars in this country, the frontier wars. I really appreciate that. And of course, you can find that podcast on 989fm.com.au if you'd like to catch up a little bit later. Last week, we also spoke to the daughter of Captain Reginald Saunders, who's one of our most awarded Aboriginal soldiers and was the first officer commissioned in the Australian Army. So that's also on 989fm.com.au as well if you want to check it out. Today, we're changing subject and talking about a issue or a subject that I'm particularly interested in, and I think a lot of blackfellas all around the country are gradually becoming more interested in as well as we sort of unlock these secrets of the past, and it's about Aboriginal astronomy. And I'm sure a lot of you and your respective mobs have these stories that haven't been chronicled or have come to light. I'm sure there's a lot of stories still out there of how blackfellas use the night sky. Today we're talking to an American, actually, Bob Fuller, who's been doing a PhD in Aboriginal astronomy, cultural astronomy. And he joins me on the phone from Sydney, I think. Last week I spoke to him. And it's very interesting what he's discovered in his research around the Kamilaroi peoples and how they use the sky as star maps, not particularly as navigational tools, but as memory aids. I find this fascinating. I think there's a lot of Western science that could be informed by the knowledges that obviously built over 60,000 years amongst our country, and it hasn't been lost. I think it shows the real true strength of our cultures that we still have this knowledge coming through. So without further ado, here's my interview with Bob Fuller about Aboriginal astronomy. First of all, can I just ask you, you're obviously not from Australia. How did you get to, I guess, Australia and get into this sort of line of work?
Yeah, well, of course, I grew up in the United States, as you can obviously tell. I came to the United States in the late 60s, early 70s. I was in the American Air Force and actually spent 3 years with the RAF over here. Met my wife in Sydney, and we went back to the U.S. for a little while and decided that we would much rather spend the rest of our life in Australia. So we came back here in 77, and I spent most of my working career working for a Swedish company. And when I retired, my background is I was trained as an anthropologist, but never worked in the field. Right. And I've always been interested in astronomy, and I was a very active member of astronomy club here in Sydney for many years, still I am, Northern Sydney Astronomical Society. And about the time I was retiring, Dwayne Homaker and Ray Norris, who are the people who probably have done most to develop the field of cultural astronomy here in Australia, they came and gave a lecture at my astronomy club, and we got to talking, and they asked about my background, and said, well, why don't you come do some work with us when you retire, which I did. And next thing I know, they talked me into doing a master's at Macquarie University. Yeah. And that's now led on to a PhD, which I'm just about 8 months into at University of New South Wales. So that's my life story, pretty much.
I mean, it's very interesting. You said you had an amateur sort of interest in astronomy, but also a professional background in anthropology. So it must have seemed like a very convenient sort of mixing the two when you talk about cultural astronomy.
Yeah, it has been, actually. It's probably the perfect sort of background for that, even though when I say I was trained as an anthropologist, it was only an undergraduate and never really worked in the field. But, of course, I've always been interested in, and when I came to Australia, I was always interested in Aboriginal culture. And while I didn't work in that field, I kept up on it a little bit. So it was a fairly easy transition into this.
It's very interesting because I often find Australians aren't as interested in Aboriginal culture, but a lot of foreigners who come over, that's the things that they want to discover most. Was that your experience?
That's very interesting because obviously I'm a Yank. Dwayne Homaker's a Yank. Ray Norris is a Palm. And at present, in our little group of people who are working at various levels on degrees and projects, we've got another Palm and we've got a Portuguese lady. And I think we've probably got about two Aussies in the whole group.
That's amazing. But, I mean, it is a very small field, and hopefully we'll talk about it a bit later. But first of all, I wanted to actually ask you, how do you define cultural astronomy, I guess, for our listeners' point of view?
Well, cultural astronomy is a multidisciplinary field, basically. It covers a number of things. Within cultural astronomy, you find something called archaeoastronomy, which is where people are looking at the astronomy of pre-literate people, in other words, before there was literature. And then you have ethnoastronomy, which is really what I'm doing, working with people who exist today and looking at their astronomy. And you also include in that the astronomy that's written down as well. And a few other side fields like geomythology. Dwayne does quite a bit of that, working with meteors and things like that. You're looking at the connection between geological and astronomical events and people's stories. So it's quite a multidisciplinary field, and cultural astronomy covers quite a bit of different things.
Do you think it's a bit confronting, I guess, for Western science? Because when you see all the science programs, it's very much focused on particularly sort of British sort of finding out things from a Western point of view. I mean, is it confronting for sort of mainstream science, this field of cultural astronomy?
I think maybe it could have been in the past. I think it's a little bit less so now. I certainly find that Western-trained astronomers or astrophysicists find this area quite fascinating. I mean, Ray Norris is a perfect example. He's a radio astronomer, a very highly regarded radio astronomer working for a CSIRO, but yet he finds this absolutely fascinating, and he can put them together. I mean, you do run into occasional conflicts where the belief system that you're looking at in indigenous astronomy just completely is different than what you would believe as a Western astronomer. But it's part of the, part of the background in working in this field, where you have to basically look at people from the standpoint of how they see the universe. It's called cosmology, actually. I mean, Western science-trained cosmologists are looking at the universe, you know, with multiple instruments, whereas Aboriginal people, their cosmology is what they saw in the night sky. And they're both cosmologies. One is based on Western science, the other is based on Aboriginal belief systems. So you really have to understand both to feel comfortable in this field. But I think it tends to work quite well.
Now, when you talk about that, I mean, when you you obviously had this background in astronomy, when did you start sort of looking up at the night sky and sort of seeing things maybe different? I mean, you've seen things from a Western point of view, but there's a whole other way to view the night sky, I guess.
Oh, there is, and I quite enjoy. I'm a member of an amateur astronomy society, and we often go out with our telescopes and look at the night sky. But I quite enjoy teaching them about how Aboriginal people see the sky as well. And within the society, there's people who have become quite interested in this now and understand the difference between, you know, what they're looking at through a telescope and what they're looking at with the naked eye at the night sky. And, you know, when I'm giving talks to the public on Indigenous astronomy and cultural astronomy. I mean, one of the things that I often say is that, you know, Aboriginal people have lived in this country for 50, 60,000 years. Mm. Every night they're basically sitting there and they don't have television. So what do? They're looking at the night sky. And that's why it's so important to Aboriginal culture, Indigenous culture, is that the night sky makes up at least 3 or 4 hours of every day and becomes quite important in the culture.
So I guess when you consider just how long Aboriginal people have been on this land, and you consider how much time they would have spent looking at the night sky, would you say they developed a sophisticated sort of form of science based around this? And considering that obviously things change as well in the sky as things move?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair statement. I mean, there's more to it than just the knowledge of the sky. I mean, Aboriginal science, Indigenous science, is a well-known field now and is being explored more and more. Their science knowledge in areas of say, resources and botany and biology and all those things is becoming quite well-known, and we call that Indigenous science. So the same way that they're looking at the night sky, they are using the night sky for things which are important to them, whether it's cultural or whether it's for resources or telling them something about the seasons or what the weather's going to do in the next few days or something like that. Yes, they use the night sky in a fairly scientific manner.
Now, I'd like to really talk about your research as well. Why did you decide to look particularly at a certain group, I guess, of Aboriginal people, which is the Kamilaroi in New South Wales?
Yeah, well, it's really the Kamilaroi and the Uwalie, who Uwalie are a little bit northwest of the Kamilaroi, and they live in the area between Walgett, Brawerna, and up into Queensland. But the two language groups are quite closely connected in their culture, and I got into it because Ray Norris, who was one of my supervisors at Macquarie, and I were trying to find a project I could work on when I decided to do a degree there in doing it in cultural astronomy. And he'd been contacted by Greg Griffiths from Gunnedah, who had said that he knew a little bit about Kamilaroi astronomy and wanted if we could talk to him. And so Ray sent me up to Greg, and we sat down and realized that he did have some knowledge and he had a lot of good contacts in the Kamilaroi community as well. So we decided we'd do Kamilaroi, and we added the Uwalie later. And in the course of meeting a lot of people who were basically people who were telling me their stories, I also met Tilar Michael Anderson, who lives in Gadigal, who is a Uwalie culture person. And he became very important in my project because Michael can trace his culture, his family, back to the time when white people first came to the Northwest up there. And not only that, his family appear to have very, very good knowledge of their culture, and they passed that down to him. And so with some persuasion, I was able to actually get Michael to get quite involved in this project. And out of that, it's come a lot of fairly interesting new areas of knowledge about cultural astronomy. But the Kamilaroi as well have a very rich cultural astronomy, and there never been that much written about it before. So that was one of the reasons that I went in that direction with that first project.
I mean, I guess there's always this perception that because of obviously dispossession happened more down in southern Australia, that northern Australia is sort of where all the cultural traditions continued and that there's a lot more knowledge. But that's obviously different for you, isn't it? Because you found this host of knowledge in this one field when you were talking to a lot of people down here.
Yeah, I think in most areas there's a lot more knowledge out there than people realize. It's just that, as Michael said once, it went underground because the old people were scared that the stories would be taken away from them. And oftentimes they were taken away, and then they were put in the book, and they became somebody else's story almost. So there was quite a bit of reluctance to share those kind of stories, particularly back in the older days. If you come down to Sydney, I'm now working on a project that includes coastal communities, and one of the first things I've done is had a look at the written knowledge on astronomy in the Sydney Basin area. And that's been really tough because, of course, Sydney area was where people were dispossessed first, and so much of their culture was lost very early. So there's quite a big difference between what I see in the Sydney area. That's, of course, before talking to people. That's yet to happen. But at least in the literature, there's not as much as there would have been even for the Kamilaroi, who nobody had really studied in particular before.
And what are sort of the main things that you've learned so far studying Kamilaroi and Uaalo?
Well, basically, is I was looking at the stories, but more than that, I was looking at how the sky fitted into their culture. I guess you could say that was my anthropologist coming out, though I don't advertise that a lot when I'm talking to people, because just Aboriginal people in Australia have a bit of a reluctance to engage with anthropologists, yes. Many because of the history, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yes. But the fact is that, you know, looking at Kamilaroi culture, which has its own differences from other communities, it was a case of trying to put the knowledge of the sky together with that culture and see how it actually worked within their culture. And out of that came some interesting areas. I mean, one of the ones was the emu in the sky. Now, that's been known for some time, and I think in our field, most people now realize that the emu in the sky is pretty commonly known all across Aboriginal Australia. But for the Kamilaroi, it was more than just a particular emu that they would see up there certain times of the year. They actually saw it as appearing differently depending on the time of the year. So when it first came up in the autumn, April, May period, they would see the emu as running.
Right.
And that was actually the female emu running after the male because there was mating time. And then a little bit later in the year, they would see the emu as sitting down in the sky. And that was actually the male emu who was hatching the eggs.
Yeah, right.
Then further on, they would see the emu looking a little bit different because basically it would look more like an egg. And that was telling them, the other thing too is, of course, that once they see the emu sitting, they know that it's time to go harvest the egg. So that's... And emu eggs were very important in their economy. And then later on, they saw it as an egg, and that told them that the chicks were forming so that they shouldn't be collecting the eggs anymore. So it was an important thing in their resource management to tell them how to deal with a very important resource, which was emu.
So they sort of looked up in the sky and sort of the universe had an impact of what they were doing on the ground.
Oh, yeah. And that seems to be the more we learn, the more we see this right across all the different communities in Australia and the Torres Strait as well, is that the sky is very, very important as a indicator of the seasons, of when you do this, when you do that, what resources are available now. It really was important on a day-to-day basis because it would tell them, you know, basically what they could do.
When you looked at this emu when you first saw it, I mean, obviously we look, Aboriginal people would look at the sky very differently, wouldn't they, including the way the constellations are formed. When you looked at the emu, maybe not knowing what it was, you would have seen a completely different constellation, wouldn't you? Because it's just about the stars.
I would have seen the Milky Way and a couple of the Western constellations that were in that area, which is the Southern Cross and Scorpius. And, of course, the Aboriginal people see not so much the star patterns, though sometimes they'll look at a pattern of stars, but they look at the dark spaces. And in the sky in the southern hemisphere, there are a lot of dark places because we're looking at the main part of the Milky Way. and there's a lot of dust in the Milky Way. And that's what actually creates the dark patches, the dark nebulas. And the EMU is really just a dust band that runs from the Southern Cross all the way down through Scorpius along the Milky Way, and has the shape of an EMU, basically. Once you've seen it, I mean, it's very hard to see in Sydney. I've seen it vaguely in Sydney. But if somebody had asked me before to try to make it out, I never would have been able to do it. But once you go out to a dark place like Western New South Wales, it becomes so obvious. Once you see it, you'll never unsee it.
Is it a sort of a constellation you can only really see in the Southern Hemisphere, or can you see it all over the world?
No, it's pretty much Southern Hemisphere, and it's interesting that other places in the Southern Hemisphere see it as well, but they see it as something else. I think in South America, it's seen as either a rhea, which is a bird, not too unlike an emu, or it's also seen, I think, by one indigenous group there as a llama, I believe. So, and I think there's also something like that in South Africa. So it's pretty much restricted to the Southern Hemisphere.
And you mentioned before that, I mean, we all know it, there's emu stories all over Australia. I mean, what does that suggest to you? Does it suggest people were sort of trading these stories?
Oh, yeah. I mean, stories were just like trading goods in Australia. People, as we now know, traveled enormous distances in Australia for trade. They went distances for ceremonies with other communities. And sometimes they went long distances just to tell somebody about a new story that they heard, most likely in a song form.
Well, that leads us right into your next form of research, isn't it, which is the star maps that you sort of discovered just talking to people like Michael Anderson.
Yeah, well, this specifically came from Michael, and now that it's sort of out and I talk about it, I'm hearing from other Aboriginal people, yes, they'd heard of this as well. But nobody had ever sort of taken the time to sit down and work it all out and put it out there for the community to look at. But Michael had a very clear understanding of this, and it was passed down by his granny, I think. And being up in Gadigal, which, if you don't know where that is just a bit northwest of Lightning Ridge, his people traveled in the old days before disruption. They traveled quite long distances. They traveled all the way up through into Queensland, up to Carnarvon Gorge, which is where they had ceremonies with other people. They traveled to north of Brisbane, to the Bunya Mountains, where every 3 years there was more or less a Bunya festival where the Bunya people invited people from all over the southeast to come and share the bunyas with them, bunya nuts with them. And they also, at least another route I was shown, was out to Quilpie in Queensland, which is about 700 kilometers from Gadigal, and quite a long walk.
Right.
So these were routes that they walked. And the interesting thing that came out about these star maps was that what was interesting was that the fact that they had a method of teaching somebody how to walk to these destinations without actually having been there. And it was, according to Michael's knowledge, it was done in the late winter camp. And somebody who had been to one of these locations would teach people who were going to travel that summer, because they normally traveled in the summertime. And what they did is they used a pattern of stars in the sky that are visible at that time of the year.
Right.
Didn't even have to be in the direction of where they were going to travel. It was just a memory aid. A lot of people have trouble understanding this, but the stars were not used for navigation. They were used as a memory aid.
Right.
To teach the waypoints along the route. And I use waypoints very deliberately. That's a GPS term.
Yeah.
And it's very much like GPS travel, where you travel along a direction and then you find a place where you stop and you either stay overnight or you change directions and head to another place. And these are often, apparently often, water holes.
Right. So it's like they were reading directions in the sky that had just been sort of written there for them to remember.
But they didn't have them there while they were walking.
Right.
These were only as a memory aid, because this is the interesting thing that came out of the whole project, is the instructions on how to walk the route included those. Each of those stars was a waypoint, but each of those stars had some name or story connected to it, and we believe that the route was sung to the person who was learning the route, and they had to learn it by singing. Right. And we know that that song is one of the easier ways to remember a list. And so they basically learned the route as a song. Mm-hmm. And that song would contain each of these waypoints, which would tell them, okay, you stop here, you turn and go this direction, and eventually you get to your end route. Now, also interesting in this is the suggestion that maybe this is how some of the song lines actually began.
So they began as star maps and sort of
as star maps, because as we know, song lines are songs that cross a landscape. Now, Aboriginal people say that the landscape created the song.
Right.
I won't argue with that, but on the other hand, it could also be that the song was created to help people travel over the landscape. So it may be that song lines and star maps and traveling were all very closely connected.
It's incredibly interesting and incredibly poetic, probably the most poetic way to give directions that I've ever heard of, I think.
I was just going to say that, you know, people often say, well, why didn't they use a map or something like that to teach somebody? The thing is, we can't find any evidence that maps were used. Mm. I mean, maybe people did mud maps on the ground, but particularly up in the Northwest, there's no evidence of any maps on, say, rock art or anything like that. We haven't been able to find any portable maps. And it does appear that the easiest way to teach somebody to walk one of these routes would be to teach them a song that they then remember.
It's really significant, too, because I guess there's another perception that oral history can't be trusted. But obviously, in this case, it is very, you know, trustworthy, and it's been handed down for thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's even more that's come out quite recently that's been quite astounding for people who think about oral history. I mean, I don't know if you saw the David Attenborough program on the Reef that started, I think it was Sunday night or Monday night. There was a community up in Cairns, and Attenborough was talking about, you know, how the reef was formed and when the water rose to actually drown the coastal area where the reef is now located. There's a language of community up in Cairns who still have a dance which more or less talks about when the sea level rose.
Okay.
And when they had to move back inland. And this actually probably was connected to some research that was done last year, where they went around, researchers, and I can't remember where they were from,
from Sunshine Coast Uni, actually. I remember reading about this.
Yeah, that could be it. They went around to coastal communities and asked them about stories that they might have about sea level rise. And I think they went to 25 communities, and they got about 20 stories out of it. And in those stories was some geographical information, you know, things like, oh, we were on an island here and we had to leave and go inland and so on. And they started to compare this to the hydrography of, you know, the undersea out from that community. And they found there was a big connection between the stories and what they could see underwater there. In other words, they could see where there might have been an island that was drowned, and that was in the story.
Yeah, right.
Now, the last, as we know, the last major sea level rise was about 9,000 years ago.
Wow.
And that would indicate that oral stories can be transmitted accurately for 9,000 years. I mean, before this, I looked into this a little bit because I thought it connected to the star maps. Before this, the general opinion was 200 to 500 years, maybe, was as long as the story could last.
Wow.
But the way Aboriginal people, and I suspect most First Peoples around the world, taught this knowledge, there could be anywhere from 3 to 4 generations who had this knowledge at the same time. That would tend to reinforce the knowledge and mean that it doesn't go the way of Chinese whispers and becomes, you know, a story that can be kept pretty accurate for a very, very long period of time. And interesting area.
It very much is, and it really excites me because regardless of all the dispossession and all the horrific things that happened in Australia, just how much that knowledge can survive. Does that amaze you sometimes when you look at particularly the star maps and what you're finding out now and how they may connect to songlines?
Oh, yeah. And I'm really looking forward to talking to saltwater communities as well. And just, you know, I'm getting some hints already from when I'm recruiting communities that there are people who know things about, you know, about stories up and down the coast. Because in the end, what I'm trying to do not only is learn the astronomy of coastal communities on the East Coast here, I'd also like to see how the stories connect up and also how those stories might have gotten from one to the other.
Yeah, right.
Because as a lot of people know, there's a major dreaming track that runs up and down the East Coast, and I suspect this was a route of travel for stories as well. And if we can show that, I think that'll be quite interesting.
It'll be absolutely amazing. And the other thing I find really interesting about the prospect of cultural astronomy in particular is how Aboriginal knowledges could actually help science. I'm just thinking of cases where, you know, they go into ancient times and they actually find stories of things like supernovas that they've found. I mean, is that something that has been coming up or has, in your knowledge, ever come up that Aboriginal knowledges might actually inform Western science, maybe an astronomical event sometime in the far past?
Yeah, I mean, certainly things like meteors. There's a very well-known case, which is William Stansfield, who was a farmer down in Victoria in the 1850s, and he spoke or learned the astronomy of a group or a community called Burong, who were in Western Victoria, and he wrote it down. I think he might have been the first person to write down any astronomical knowledge of Aboriginal people in Australia sometime in the late 1850s, I think. And while that information there is not specifically about an event, there is some knowledge that came from him, I believe, that indicates it could have been that Aboriginal people recognized the eruption of a massive supergiant star called Eta Carinae, which is in the Milky Way.
Wow.
And it had one of these periodic eruptions around that time. And I'm look up Dwayne Homaker's work on that, you'll find that it looks like they reported this. So there was one case there where, even though that was well known in Western astronomy, the fact that they had written it down is quite interesting. And one of the things that we as cultural astronomers are trying to do, of course, is trying to find cases where knowledge might come from before, you know, European invasion in Australia as well. There's not any specific cases of that yet, but I mean, we get hints of it all the time. And, we'll just have to see what happens in the future. We're hoping that we'll find more information like that.
It's really interesting. I remember Dwayne was telling us when we interviewed him last year something about in the oral history, there's like tidal waves down in Victoria that they're just checking out to see if it might potentially fit with sort of the geological records down there. It's just phenomenal when you actually think of this, what the stories could lead to.
Yeah. I think there are cases like that. That's down around Portland, I think, and there does seem to be some evidence of a tsunami or something down there, but I think they're still trying to work out when that actually happened. But if you can keep stories going for 9,000 years in other areas, I'm sure there must be stories that are still going which have to do with things, events like that. And, of course, the geomythology is an area that Dwayne's very active in, and he may very well have something like that soon.
It's pretty amazing. And getting back to your own research, the other interesting thing I thought was when you were actually mapping these star maps, how close, when you put them on Google Maps, for example, how close they sort of mirrored the current roads that are currently there. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, they're reasonably close. I mean, in this conversation article I put up, there was a lot of discussion about whether they were really accurate or not. And I think probably I might have misled people to think that they were dead accurate. No, they're close, because I think the routes that were being shown in the star maps were the routes that eventually were taught to the early European explorers up there. And then those routes eventually became droving tracks and eventually became roads. But the star maps, as Michael told me about them, are not supposed to look exactly like the route on the ground. Yeah. I mean, it would, obviously, you'd be really pressed to find a pattern of stars that would be exactly like a road, like a road map. But they're pretty close, and they go in the general direction and sort of curve in the general direction that you would go if you're walking on the ground. The point I was trying to make about that was that the routes that were taught with the star maps, when the first explorers came along, they were being guided by Aboriginal people,
yep,
probably from where they came from. So the Aboriginal guides would have been talking to the local people about, you know, what's the best way to go up this way. And they'd be getting instructions probably from people who traveled those routes that were described in the star maps. And, you know, we know that the routes probably came before the star maps, because people tended to travel the easiest routes, you know, along a river or across a hill through a cutting or something like that. But those eventually became the routes that were described in the star map.
Right.
And
because it was just memory, was, as you were saying, it's just a way
just
to
memory. That's yourself. Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and of course, if the explorers like Mitchell went up to the area in some of these star maps in 1845, 46, and that one of those routes is the Castlereagh Highway that runs up into Queensland.
Yeah, right.
And it could very well be that Mitchell walked that way, and that eventually became a route for the drovers and the settlers. And, of course, that becomes a dirt road, which becomes a highway.
So do you think this thing about star maps, that could potentially be something that was common across Australia? Because I think we often hear about the stars being used as navigation aids, particularly up in the Torres Strait, but across Australia, was that potentially how blackfellas probably used the stars, more as memory aids rather than as sort of that navigational?
Yeah, I think they did use it for navigation some. As has been said to me a number of times by Aboriginal people, I mean, we walk in the daytime. Who wants to walk around at night and stumble and step on things? So they didn't use celestial navigation in the sense that, you know, they would go out and say, okay, look at the stars, and that tells me where I am. But they could certainly use stars to go in a specific direction. Bill Harney, who's up in Northern Territory, his community obviously used the stars for traveling at night, because he talks about it.
Right.
And he seemed to have very good knowledge of how to travel which directions at night. But once again, it wasn't celestial navigation. It was a means of traveling in the right direction. The star maps were something that was just a teaching aid to help people travel in the daytime.
Yeah. God, it's so fascinating. What next for you, I guess? What are you hoping to sort of
Well, actually, the star map story is not ended. Michael and I are talking about driving one of these routes, possibly the one up to the Bunya Mountains this wintertime. Yeah. He knows a couple of the water holes, he thinks, already, and he's been talking to some of the old people up in that area that he knows about some of the other ones, and we're going to see if we can actually follow the star map route and find the waypoints on it. You know, there are wells and water holes up in that area that people know about, and it may very well be that we can follow the route and actually pin it down. One of the things that we're looking at is that he's got some ideas about how people knew which direction to leave a waypoint, possible markings on rocks or things like that.
All right.
And we're going to look into that as well. So that's not finished, though that's not the major part of my PhD work at the moment, which is with coastal people. But I'm pretty sure that the star maps are universal in Australia. It just makes so much sense that people would use these kind of techniques to travel.
You mentioned earlier at the start of the conversation about Sydney and about how hard it is to sort of piece together what happened there. Can you tell me a bit more about your research, particularly around Sydney? I find that really interesting because it's such a major city now.
Yeah, well, at the moment, my research is only in the literature because I'm still waiting to get my ethics approval quite so I can start yarning with people, but that's coming pretty soon. And, you know, I will be talking to people in the next 6 months or so, and hopefully there's more knowledge out there, but there are some fairly large gaps in the knowledge. And, for example, the Darug people, particularly the Western Darug people, I have not been able to find a single story that connects them to their astronomy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I've barely been able to find a cultural story that's identified as Darug. And having talked to a few people who worked with Darug most of their careers, they said it's very, very hard to find that people just lost all that so early on.
Yeah, it's so sad. I mean,
it is very sad.
In one sense, it's amazing because you realize just how because I guess Aboriginal people were dehumanized for so long. They were seen as being these primitive Stone Age people, and it was the exact opposite, you know. We had such sophisticated land management, astronomy, science, so many other things that was all sort of intrinsically linked. Learning about this knowledge actually props us up as a people, and I think it's a real sort of sledgehammer to all the racism around as well, because it's about...
Yeah, I think it's wonderful, actually. I mean, I'm doing my little tiny bit here because I believe in this, but, you know, you look at people like Bill Gammage and, I'm just trying to think who else.
Bruce Pascoe.
Bruce Pascoe, who basically have been... who've been researching most of their lives are now starting to publish very clear descriptions how Aboriginal people were farmers and land management and everything else. And people are starting to wake up to this. I'm getting it more and more now when I go out and talk to people that they'll be asking questions, you know, which indicates that they've read this and they're interested in this. And I think it's just one little part in the whole reconciliation puzzle, I guess you could say.
And just the last question, I mean, when you talk about land management, I guess astronomy and the work you're doing will actually really sort of complement that, won't it? Because it seems that what the Blackfellas use the sky for and what they use the land, they were very much connected, weren't they? I mean, learning more about the sky will learn more about the land, it seems.
Yeah, I think so. At least their use of the land, like in resources, and you know how much detail we'll ever be able to recover in certain areas is still to be seen. I mean, there's an enormous amount of work to be done in Australia with cultural astronomy, and there's not a lot of us working in the field at this stage. But we hope it'll become more popular. And one of the things we're trying to do is we're trying to recruit Indigenous students to work in this field because we think it's an exciting area, and if they can find work in this field, because it's not a paid profession, it would be great if they were working, because then they probably can talk to people and find out a lot more than a bunch of white people like myself.
Yeah, that's very true. And thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Let's Talk with Amy McGuire on 98.9 FM.
That was Bob Fuller, who's part of the Indigenous astronomy team down at the University of New South Wales. He actually studied anthropology at uni before going on a completely different route and coming back in his later years to study particularly Aboriginal astronomy, became quite interested in astronomy and then obviously Aboriginal cultures. And he joined us there on the phone from Sydney talking about his research into Aboriginal star maps, which he was saying were very interesting, the way Blackfellas seem to have used them, not particularly as navigational tools, which is, I guess, has been sort of the common story told previously, but as memory aids to get places and really important in relation to trade routes. So hopefully we'll catch up with him at another point. I'm very interested to see where his research takes him. And also I want to, I guess, encourage a lot of young blackfellas out there who may not consider a career in STEAM, which is science, technology, engineering, arts, and something else I can't remember at the moment. But really encourage you to go out and particularly consider that as a career option, because we obviously have so much knowledge that isn't being studied by our own mob, you know, and I think that's really important that in particularly in the field of cultural astronomy and Aboriginal astronomy that we get more young blackfellas getting in and studying that, because it's a fascinating area and I'd really love to see some of our young students doing that. But thanks so much for joining me today on Let's Talk. Just a reminder that you can catch the podcast at 989fm.com.au if you missed it. You can also find it on iTunes in the podcast store if you look up Let's Talk. We'll be back tomorrow. I'll be speaking a bit more about last couple of weeks ago now, the Royal Commission into Family Violence was delivered down in Victoria. So I've spoken to Jackie Huggins and Dr. Kylie Cripps at the University of New South Wales, Jackie Huggins from the National Congress, about what this particularly could mean. So that'll be coming up tomorrow. Meanwhile, I hope you have a great day. I'll leave you with a couple of songs. Stay safe and I'll see you tomorrow with Let's Talk.